You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Well, it is awesome to be here. My hope, as I was just praying a moment ago, is that God would pour out joy upon your heart. By the time you leave here, we'd be floating out of here with joy at who Jesus is. And I want to start by just making it as much as I can a safe place to have questions and doubts. That's what we're going to basically be talking about tonight. And it is one of the greatest passions of my life. When I think about my vocation, I think I can say it is the great passion of my life to be a friend to people who are having doubts and who have anxiety and angst about ultimate questions of life. I know what that feels like. I think most of us who are here have been through or will go through seasons like that, whether we're a professing believer or maybe we're just exploring ultimate questions. And I guarantee you, all of us know people who are truly in a state of angst. And I just want to start tonight by acknowledging the pain of that, especially for some of you who may know those emotions right now. You may have been through it in the past. There was a famous pastor named G. Campbell Morgan who grew up in a wonderful Christian home, but he went through a season of doubt. And he said that in the worst of it, there came a moment when I was sure of nothing. Just think about those words. You know, there's nothing that you're certain about. That is a dark place to be. And the truth of it is that sometimes mature Christians go through those seasons, not just immature Christians. C.S. Lewis was a world-famous apologist when he wrote a book called A Grief Observed. And he was so raw in that book in talking about this sense of God's hiddenness that people literally did not believe he wrote the book, because it came out with a pseudonym and people were saying, no, there's no way that C.S. Lewis, the same guy who wrote these other books, is being so honest about his sense of God's hiddenness. I'm going to read you a passage from this. This will set the tone for tonight, but by the way, we're going to hopefully get to hope through all this, so don't think we're going to be like this the whole time. At one point he says, meanwhile, where is God? This is one of the most disquieting symptoms. I'll get to this text on screen in a moment. When you are happy, so happy that you have no sense of needing God, if you remember yourself and turn to him with gratitude and praise, you will be welcomed with open arms. But go to him when your need is desperate and when all other help is vain, and what do you find? A door slammed in your face and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. After that, silence, you may as well turn away. The longer you wait, the more emphatic the silence will become. There are no lights on in the windows. I just love the honesty. As a follower of Jesus, I want to be honest. And if I read the book of Psalms rightly, there's moments where we feel like this. And I have to say, Ian and I were just talking about this a few moments ago, I think we live in a time where we're seeing an increase of people who feel this way. And I think we have a Savior whose heart has compassion for those who are drowning in anxiety, trying to figure out ultimate questions of life. And many of us want to serve them. We want to give our lives to help them. And the good news is there is an answer to that anguish. If I could boil it down, I'm just going to call it the testimony of the Holy Spirit to your heart. Streams of living water flowing through your heart, testifying to your heart in a way that is more certain than anything else you know, that your sins are forgiven, that heaven is your home, that God sees and knows and loves you. And we want to share that with people right now. So here's what we're going to focus on tonight. I would like for us to think about the role of beauty in helping our friends get to that point of peace and joy in our hearts, and helping ourselves when we need it, because it's always the overflow of what Jesus has done in us that we then have to share with others. So often when we are in the C.S. Lewis spot here, we're just looking for arguments, we're looking for truth, And one of the things that I think we need to do is look at what the ancient philosophers spoke of as the transcendentals, the good, the true, and the beautiful, and see that Jesus is all three. So we'll just ask two questions, and we'll go fast. First question is, why do we need beauty when we're sharing about Jesus with others? And then the second question is to get very practical, so it won't feel too abstract, and just say, how do we do that? And we'll look at five features of our world that reflect the beauty of Jesus. So first, why do we need beauty when we're talking about Jesus? Now, I'm going to share a favorite passage from the book, The Lord of the Rings. I love this book. I quote from it all the time. Whenever I'm guest speaking, I feel like I get guilt-free Lord of the Rings quotes, because usually when I do it, my church at home is tired of me quoting Lord of the Rings all the time. So you haven't heard me quote this before, so we can have a fresh start here, but it's a great passage where one character wakes up from a sleep. He suffered terribly, horrific suffering. That's the honesty, right? He's greeted by an old friend that he thought was dead, and he realizes he's alive. And it says this, "The joy that filled him was so powerful that he was unable to speak." And then I'm just summarizing here. They break into laughter. It says laughter was like the sound of water on parched land, and it fell on his ears like the echo of all the joys he had ever known. I often think that's what the first 15 seconds of heaven will feel like, the echo of every joy you've ever known, the answering and fulfilling of all your happiness in this life. We'll talk about that. And then he says, I feel like spring after winter and sun on the leaves, and like trumpets and harps and all the songs I have ever heard, is everything sad going to come untrue? Oh, I love that passage. And you've probably heard those words, is everything sad going to come untrue? And it's just interesting that it doesn't just say, you know, is everything sad over? That would be good too. But he's saying, is everything sad going to come untrue? And this is a picture of how the gospel should land upon the human heart. The word gospel means good news. The gospel is the message that the creator of our universe, the one who made all of us, has come into our world in the person of Jesus. He's come to restore everything to the way it should be. He's come to draw us back to fellowship with himself. If we follow Jesus, we repent of our sins. And the first installment of that everything being set right came with Jesus' resurrection. And if that message is true, it really does literally mean that everything sad is going to come untrue. I love talking about this because every time it lands upon my heart afresh, and I don't think we can think about it too much to just return to this. Maybe for some of us this will be a new idea, but for all of us to return to it if it isn't, just to think that that really is true, that one day we will say everything sad has come untrue. It's wonderful. So here's what we'll do. We're going to look down the road and compare two different options. We're going to say, what if, and I'm going to use the word naturalism. That's a big word. When you hear that, just think nature. This is just the idea that there's only physical things that exist. There's no God or gods. There's no souls. There's no afterlife. It's just physical matter. That's it. We're going to look down the road and see how beautiful that worldview is. And then we're going to look in the other direction and consider one alternative, and that's what if Jesus did rise from the dead, and we're going to think through the implications of that worldview and the emotional implications of it. And what we're going to basically suggest is, looking this way, looking if Jesus rose from the dead, it brings to your heart those feelings that Sam was saying in the book, that everything sad is going to come true. I love using metaphors. The way I think of it is, do you remember what it felt like when you woke up as a little kid and you think you have to go to school, and then it just dawns upon you that it's Christmas morning? That's like, I was trying to think of the happiest moments of my life, and that was one of the ones I first think of. It's like, oh yeah, it's Christmas. You know, it's like you're 8 years old. There's like nothing better than that. Another one of the happiest moments of my life, maybe you can relate to this. You're pursuing someone that you truly love, and for the first time, it just washes over you. Wow, she loves me too. How does that feel? Okay. Those are the kinds of emotions
that should land upon our heart like water on parched desert if Jesus rose from the dead. It is enchanting. It is enthralling. It's like waking up in a fairy tale, and the fairy tale is real. It's a message of glory. It's a message of infinite, reverberating, dynamic, dramatic, ever-expanding joy. Part of the reason for that is, of course, heaven. The gospel includes heaven. And so what we want to think about is that in the task of sharing Jesus with our friends, we want to help people feel that. We want them to know this is a message of incredible good news. Now, we need to respond to that message to experience that joy. But that's the thing we have to offer to people. And I just find this is absolutely, I don't want to overstate it, but I almost have to say it feels like it's necessary right now. And I want to share three reasons why I think it's necessary. But let me set it up by this great quote from an old philosopher who put it like this. He said, "Men despise religion. They hate it and fear that it is true." Now, just pausing right there for a second, if we're wise evangelists and we want to be skillful at sharing Jesus with others, we need to remember that people are afraid we might be right. Sometimes we experience that kind of conversation in the way of opposition, but underneath that opposition, they might be absolutely terrified that we might be right. And if someone is afraid, they'll often have their defenses up. So Pascal says, to remedy this, we must begin by showing that religion is not contrary to reason, that it is venerable. In other words, say, this is respectable. Then, to inspire respect for it. Then we must make it lovable to make good men hope it is true. Finally, we must prove it is true. What I basically want to say tonight, to boil it down, is too often we start at that third step when we're trying to share about Jesus with our friends. So we go straight to trying to argue that it's true. And there's a psychological wisdom in Pascal's strategy to start further back and say, first show it's respectable, it's worthy of a conversation. That's really sometimes where we need to start today. A lot of people are just not even thinking about it. I will never forget, I was doing evangelism once where I used to live in California in Ojai, and I was ready to go with an argument and talk with my friend, and I said, well, you know, we got to the point in the conversation, I said, tell me, who do you think Jesus was? And I was ready to go based upon if he had said, well, he's a good moral teacher or whatever he might say, and he said, I don't know, I've never thought about it. And I was like, you know, that was such a light bulb moment for me of where we have to start further back sometimes. And, you know, that's the starting guy showing it's worthy of a conversation, right? The second stage is, he says, show that it's desirable. Make people want to believe it. Help the defenses to come down a little bit. Let me just give three reasons really quickly why I think we need to do that. One is, we live in such a time of disenchantment and cynicism. I think so often the great barrier that we have in getting into conversations about Jesus with our friends is that people are very apathetic about ultimate questions. Sometimes it's not the counter-arguments that we have to anticipate. It's just the sense of people are distracted and thinking about other things. And beauty is a great tool to cut through the distraction and arrest the attention. I remember there was a famous Christian who was giving a series of lectures at a university in Europe, and the first, he had back-to-back nights, and the first night it just went terribly, which, by the way, when you're a public speaker, that always happens sometimes, and that makes you pray, so it's good. But first night, it just, you know, just talking to a brick wall, and it was opposition. He was actually getting jeered at a little bit, and but because he was giving these arguments, trying to commend Christianity. And the second night, he had a different strategy, and all he tried to do was to basically put it in his terms. He tried to show the absurdity of life without God. He said, you know, remember the word naturalism? He was saying, look down the road. Think about, take naturalism, assume that there's nothing but nature, and think about 500 years from now, okay, 500 more years from now, and just think it through. And the atmosphere of the room changed, and it softened the defenses of his listeners because they were open to considering maybe there's some hope as an alternative to that. I think that's where we're at today. We need to help people desire the truths of the gospel before we give them to them. Another reason is just the sheer distraction, the amount of time that we're getting pulled away from ultimate things by our phones and by our other screens. I think about this all the time, even in my own life. You know, if I don't set guardrails on how frequently I'm looking at my iPhone, that affects my prayer life. Now, that's true also for the people I'm trying to evangelize. You know, in the ancient world, every night, human beings would look up and see the stars and remember how small they are. In the modern world, every night we look at our screens and we forget how small we are. Because screens make the world feel very small, but stars make the world feel very big. And you evangelize differently when you talk to someone who's been staring at screens a lot versus stars a lot, because they're asking different questions. And so we got to start further back and try to awaken that sense of desire for ultimate answers when people aren't even asking ultimate questions. The third reason I think we need to start with beauty when we're sharing about Jesus is that we live in a time of anger and outrage. I first started thinking about this a few years ago. I think it's unfortunately more the case now than it was even a few years ago. You can just feel, and underneath anger, there's almost always other emotions that are driving the anger. And I think one of them is fear. And I even wonder if one of them for some is despair. People really are searching for something hopeful right now. And I think that shows up in the questions we face. Another famous Christian I am just learning from, he was sharing his experience that 20 years ago, sharing about Jesus on university campuses, the questions were about truth, like, is God real? Did Jesus rise from the dead? But now the questions are much more about goodness, like, is Christianity homophobic? Are Christians hypocrites? Questions like this. I think that's a general cultural shift that informs the way we do evangelism, the way we reach out to our friends, and I think beauty can help us so much in the process. So that's all the setup to say, how might we go about that? And what I'd love for us to do for this second half now is just give five examples of features in our world. And what we'll do with each one is I'll put it out on the table. And then we'll do a thought experiment and look down the road each direction. We'll say, okay, if it's naturalism and there's nothing beyond nature, what does that mean for this? And if it's Christianity and Jesus rose from the dead, what does that mean for this? And in each case, what we want to try to see for our own hearts and then for our sharing with others is that Christianity doesn't just give you a more intellectually compelling answer. It gives you a more emotionally satisfying one. Christianity doesn't just give you a plausible story. It just gives you a flat-out better story. And it speaks to your heart and the deepest longings of your heart. I love following Jesus for so many reasons. Christianity is the most important thing in my heart, the most important thing in my life. One of those reasons is truth. I believe it is just a knockdown, literal truth that Jesus rose from the dead. But another one is, it speaks to the questions of my heart. It gives me hope every single day, and it can do that for you as well. So let's talk about five features of our world. This will get a little bit nerdy, but here we go. We're going to talk about justice, love, math, music, and hope. And hopefully you'll understand a little bit more why we're talking about these as we go. Outrage about injustice, I think, may be the strongest emotion in our culture right now. And so we want to be mindful of that and think about that, of how does that intersect with the gospel. There are lots of disagreements about what injustice is. But what both sides and everybody in the middle can agree upon is that injustice is a bad thing. And we understand intuitively the deep longing in the human heart for justice. I love my favorite image for thinking about when Jesus returns. You know, by the way, when Jesus comes back and it says in the Apostles' Creed to judge the quick and the dead, that's a good thing. That's part of the gospel. That's part of the good news. I like to think of that as everything crooked gets made straight. And shalom returns to the world. And he restores everything to the way it should be. By the way, happy note, if you've ever been a victim of injustice, I don't think there's any hope like that to know that Jesus is going to set all things right. That's the Savior we have. And one of the ways we see this in our culture is movies. Everybody's talking about, apparently there's a new Superman movie. I haven't seen it yet. Now I really want to see it, but I'm traveling, so I can't. But I'm happy to be here instead. But I'll be seeing it when I get back home because I love movies. And movies are a great way to get a baseline feel for culture. If you stop and think about it, every single movie is telling you the same thing over and over again to the point that we don't even notice it. We just assume it in movies, and that's good and evil are fighting. Good loses for a while, and then eventually good wins. Almost every movie. There's a few exceptions to that. But even in the exceptions where the bad guys win in the end, you usually feel that something is off about that. And when you draw attention to that, there's almost always this moral resolution and then a happy ending that's deep in the human heart, the ache for justice, the ache for things to be set right. Now, when you think about that, that's absolutely fascinating. Why should it be that way? Why should we tell stories instinctively that are like this? And I read that scene from J.R.R. Tolkien earlier. He has a theory about that. He says the human instinct to tell stories like that is because we're made in the image of God, and therefore we can't help but tell stories that are patterned after reality. We'll feel how happy this point is if Jesus rose from the dead. So let's just do our thought experiment. Okay, so we can recognize deep in the human heart, there's a longing for happy endings. Deep in the human heart, we desire that good should defeat evil, so much so that we tell stories about that instinctively, and we all feel how unsatisfying it would be if you are watching a movie and it gets to the end. And some movies are like this, and I've done videos on some of those movies and talked about that, and I find that fascinating. Here's the thought experiment. Okay, in a naturalistic worldview, why do we do that? This is pretty dark. I don't want to overstate this, but I think I need to just say it as bad as it is. In a naturalistic worldview, there's no God or gods, there's no heaven, there is no objective basis for justice. It is basically a function of our evolutionary history. And it's explained entirely by that. That is in the human heart because it helped our animal ancestors survive. Now, let me just give a quick aside here. Whenever I'm talking at a general level, I want to sort of acknowledge the complexity to something so it doesn't come across too triumphant. So this is debated, and you find the big debate between the old atheists, people like Friedrich Nietzsche and these European atheists who lived 150 years ago or 200 years ago, and the new atheists. And you know many of their names, although even they are kind of, it feels like maybe 20 years ago now, and it's fascinating to see how it's changing even now. The newer atheists are arising. But one of the big differences is the new atheists are very optimistic, and they think you can ground justice and happiness and rationality and so forth within an atheistic worldview. I think it's really hard to do that. And I think basically made this case longer elsewhere to suffice it like this. I think the old atheists were right to have a worry of how do you get any sort of transcendent referent in the human heart's longing for justice in a naturalistic worldview. It seems like that longing is two things. Number one, it's an illusion. We're longing for something that isn't out there. And number two, it's arbitrary and accidental. We might have evolved differently. And I won't even go down this road because it gets so dark, but basically what people talk about is if the evolutionary process had gone differently, we could have evolved such that we would think malice is good and kindness is bad. And you see that in some other animal species. And if you think about it for long enough, you start to see how dark that is. Okay, in the other direction, imagine if Jesus rose from the dead. What is justice there? It's just the opposite. It's not an illusion. It's not a trick. It's not cheap. It's an incredibly noble clue about ultimate reality. It is grounded in the character of our Creator God. We perceive it because we are made in His image. And actually, the stories we're telling about good triumphing over evil in movies are patterned after the story. One day there will be a happy ending. One day good will triumph over evil forever. Every wrong will be righted. Every score will be settled. Everything sad will come untrue. And so what we're doing is, you know, naturalism says this longing for justice is your brain tricking you. Christianity says this longing for justice is your heart telling you something true. One is an illusion, the other is a clue. And we're stepping back and we're saying, okay, which of these is more plausible, but also which can you actually live with? Which can you make peace with in your heart when you're thinking about the people in this love, in this world that you love the most? Or the times you've been a victim of injustice? And if we treat this topic personally, as we should, it's hard to look down that pathway at the naturalistic view. But Christianity is unbelievably, enchantingly beautiful. All right, here's the second one. I'm going to do these fast so we can have a lot of time for discussion. Now, I'm going to start this section by referencing a song from the great theological masterpiece, Frozen 2. Has anyone seen this movie? I am a father of 5 young children, 3 young girls, so I will not tell you how many times I've seen this movie, but it is well in my imagination at this point. And I actually love the songs. They're deep. This one song is called Do the Next Right Thing. You remember this song? It's pretty deep. The character Anna is singing it after she's in a dark place. And the movie is exploring themes of transience and permanence, you know, what really lasts. And there's this one very poignant scene right after singing that song where Olaf, the snowman, says, "Hey, I thought of something permanent." And Anna says, "What's that?" And Olaf says, "Love." Now, we hear that sentiment so often. It's kind of like good and evil in movies. It's just so common. We don't even think about it. We just assume it. We hear this idea that love is forever so much that we don't really think about it. You know, that's probably the most common claim in songs, right? I will love you forever. Yeah, I will always love you. Many songs like this. So we hear it so often, sometimes we don't step back and do the thought experiment and think it through. Unfortunately, this is another pretty dark one. In a naturalistic worldview, love is just not permanent. The feeling of love in our hearts has a very similar status to our conscience that tells us about justice. It came about through evolution. It affects us the way it does because it helps animals survive. It's a kind of accident. It doesn't have any transcendent referent or transcendent significance. And so you can find famous atheists who will talk about how falling in love is irrational. And I think they're being consistent with their worldview at that point. By the way, just I want to be so clear, to never be unfair. The point here is not that you have to believe in God to be a loving person. The point is that without God, there's no objective basis for that. Okay, so we consider the opposite, and this is so enthralling, I don't possibly have words to convey, but we'll just try to say love is at the core of reality. Love is what it's all about. The Father, the Son, and the Spirit love one another, and that's it. You know, that's just what is. That's just what eternity has been doing. And we don't need to exist, but that's a necessary thing that's eternal. And the Bible even says God is love. And so, if you're looking down this way, you can affirm what Olaf says as literally true. Love is forever. In fact, love is the reason the world exists. God creates out of the overflow of love and generosity. I tried to summarize this on the slide here to make the contrast vivid. We can say that in a naturalistic worldview, love is accidental. It might have never been. It's biological. It's just part of our brain chemistry. And it's functional. It's here to help animals survive. But in Christianity, love is essential. It lies at the core of reality. It's spiritual. It's prior to and after the physical world. And it's purposeful, both the cause and ultimate destination of all things. So I hope we can feel how powerful this contrast is. And what I'm suggesting is that when we're struggling, or when we're trying to help others who are struggling, it really helps to put that contrast out to people and help them feel it in their hearts. And help them feel just how good it is if Jesus, in fact, rose from the dead. It's like you've woke up in a fairy tale that's true. All right, this is where it gets a little more nerdy It'll be fast. I like thinking about this, but I'll make it quick. I didn't like math when I was growing up. It wasn't my favorite subject in school, but I've gotten interested in the nature of math because I think it's just interesting that 2 + 3 = 5, and that seems to be just true forever. The way a philosopher might put it is that in every possible world, 2 + 3 = 5. It's never going to slowly slip into equaling 4.999. It just equals 5, exactly 5, always 5, forever 5, and without any remainder. A way you can pose this as a question is, if it's naturalism, why is that? Naturalism means everything's in flux and nothing's permanent. Everything's moving around. There's nothing stable. So what would be there to make mathematical truths have this kind of binding permanence to them? Now, when I first started thinking about this, I was kind of skeptical that you could get any mileage out of this, but I started reading the philosophers of math who are not Christians, and they're wrestling with this problem of why is math so different from physical reality, and yet it maps onto it perfectly. And they use these metaphors. One is describing math like entering a different world. Another is describing math as like reading a book that someone else wrote. Another is describing math like you're an archaeologist, not an architect. That is to say, you're discovering truth, not just building it. And there's this exciting sense of discovery that this is just out there. It's like this invisible castle around us that's just binding and true and eternal and there. I won't go down this too long because I want to keep it moving. You can read that quote. This is actually a pretty powerful argument in philosophy. I'll just kind of summarize it by this. If you're looking in this direction, it's kind of this amazing, thrilling thought that math is thinking the thoughts of God after him. The old Christian idea about all abstract truths, like math, is that they're divine thoughts. They're the thoughts of God. Maybe I'm just super nerdy, but I find it amazing to think anytime you discover truth, you're thinking God's thoughts after him. And I mention this, I go into this, by the way, because I found mathematicians find this meaningful. Musicians find this one interesting sometimes. Probably of all the different things that we encounter in our world, this is the one that I have found cause those who don't believe in God to soften their defenses the most. Many times I like watching debates, and sometimes you'll hear the atheist side of a debate concede this argument. They'll say something like, I don't believe in God, but sometimes when I listen to classical music, I have doubts about my atheism. Now that's interesting. Why would that be? Well, we can do our thought experiment. And we can look down the road in each way. And in a naturalistic worldview, this is another whole area, is there's so many mysteries about music. You know, why does it convey meaning in the way that it does? Music can convey meaning in a completely different way, on a completely different wavelength than words convey meaning. And the philosophers puzzle about this and try to understand that. You don't need to be a great philosopher, though, to understand that, because all of us have had experiences listening to music where you've probably felt it. And there's absolutely no words I can use to convey this, but all I can do is hope that enough of you have had moments listening to music where you understand that there's this feeling of transcendence that often comes through. And you just have this moment where you're saying, what is this? This is absolutely enchanting. This is absolutely beautiful. From a Christian perspective, music is seen as the speech of God. And there's an old Christian tradition that says, essentially, music is the divine language by which the world was made. And this comes from the book of Job, where it says the angels sang as God made the stars. And this is how Tolkien portrays the creation of the world in the book The Silmarillion. It's the singing of angels that brings the world into being. So looking down the road each way, again, we can say it's the same kind of thing. In this worldview, a naturalistic worldview, music is an illusion. It's, again, playing with our brain chemistry in some ways, mapping onto pattern recognition and other things that have survival value, so it triggers reactions, but it's kind of an illusion. But in this worldview, you're hearing the very language by which the stars were made. And I think it helps to feel that difference and to see all that's at stake. Last one is hope. I think about this because of the profound need that we all sense in the world for hope right now. I can think of so many movies that dramatize this so powerfully. Without wanting to say too much, I think we can just summarize that looking down the road in naturalism, it's very hard to see any sort of ultimate hope. It's very hard. Could I put it vividly? Think about when you get, if you're a naturalist, and you get really, 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 really bad news from the doctor. You know, what do you do? In the other direction, if Jesus rose from the dead, I will say it like this. We don't just have hope. I believe, I'd put it like this. We have the best imaginable hope. You couldn't think of a better hope than the hope we actually have if Jesus rose from the dead. Because the resurrection means that evil and suffering won't just be ended one day. They will be undone. Somehow Jesus is able to turn suffering to glory. Somehow he's able to turn the pain of this world into joy in the next. And it means that all the happiness we know in this world is just an anticipation of the full happiness then. One pastor puts it like this. You can read this on the screen. The biblical view of things is resurrection, not a future that is just a consolation for the life we never had, but a restoration of the life you always wanted. This means that every horrible thing that ever happened will not only be undone and repaired, but will in some way make the eventual glory and joy even greater. And you think about that and you think, okay, that's getting us to Pascal's stage 2, right? If you really think about it through, most of us can say, yeah, I hope it's this way, and I hope it's not this way. And we want to help our friends understand that as well. That's a big part of the pie, piece of the pie. Final thought, and then we'll do some Q&A. Just stemming from this, just think back on a happy moment in your life. Maybe it was a peaceful childhood memory. Maybe it was an accomplishment and recognition. Maybe it was just a simple moment of contentment in nature. Sometimes happiness sneaks in like that. Just take a second and think about something in your life where you felt truly happy. Now, just imagine, for the sake of supposal, that you knew in your heart that that moment was not lost to you. That moment is an anticipation of an eternal happiness. It's a messenger saying, that's what is ahead of you. That's the hope we have if we know Jesus. It's the best imaginable hope, and that's the hope we want to speak to our own hearts, and then we want to share it with others as well. Thanks for listening. Let's do some Q&A now.